everybody. Welcome once again to our radio show that we call Steppin' Out. This is reality radio at its finest because it is here, like no other place you're going to hear on radio, that we discuss the subject of addiction and of recovery. Our subject tonight, got any gamblers out there? Yeah, this is about gambling, the addiction of gambling. Our special guest is Ray, and we're going to join Ray in just a couple of minutes. Thanks for joining us anyway, Ray.
Thank you, Scott. My pleasure.
The voice of Ray, and he will be back, I promise. We emanate from our broadcast studios here in New York City, and we broadcast all across this great land of ours and around the world on American Forces Radio. To that end, we thank our soldiers, our sailors, our Marines, and our airmen for keeping us safe. And thanks for listening to us, all of you, on American Forces Radio. Now, back to Ray and gambling. And we begin at the beginning. What are your beginnings, Ray?
Well, Scott, I grew up in a loving home. I was an only child, born to parents that were in their early 40s. They were not gamblers. They did like alcohol, particularly on weekends. But my gambling really kind of began innocently enough. I pitched cards and flipped cards when in my lower grammar school years. I discovered bazaars, volunteer fire department bazaars, things like that, and it was magical. It probably had the effect on me that casinos would ultimately have on adults, because the sound of that spinning wheel clicking was like the best music I had ever heard, and the anticipation of watching that wheel spin and hoping that it was going to land on a number that I put my quarter or whatever it was just magic. And bingo came along.
Did you have a card in your spokes in your bike when you were
Of course. Yeah.
Something like that, but it never clicked
to the degree that spinning wheel clicked. That was almost in a symphonic sound. It was just magic. Uh-huh. And I would always stand as close as I could to the wheel, except when I had to move the number down to if I was betting a higher number. But then I'd go back and listen. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I stumbled across of all of those kinds of games. There was a game called Double Your Money Back where you filled up a pail of water and you put a shot glass in the bottom of the pail, mm-hmm. and you would try to drop a quarter into that shot glass, and if you did, you would get it back, and if it took me 12 or 15 quarters to win once, that win was thrilling. The fact that it cost $3 or $4 was totally inconsequential. Things like that continued by eighth or ninth grade. I discovered that my dad was betting one NFL game every Sunday for $25, and I immediately invited myself into that world with him, and he was very reluctant. For a week or two, he said no. Then I pressured him enough that he finally relented, and I became his advisor.
How old were you then?
I was in either eighth or ninth grade when that began. Mm-hmm. And I remember after 5 or 6 weeks, everything was going fine, but I thought that this game that was coming up that particular weekend, I don't know if it was on the Chicago Bears or against the Chicago Bears. I just remember that they were in the game, and I told my dad we had to increase our bet, that we needed to raise it to twice the normal limit, totally on my own. We lost that game, and my dad promptly told me that I was out of the family once-a-week Sunday process. Now, you may think it was because he lost the $50, but I truly believe that my dad would die while I was in college of a heart attack. But I think he saw something there that scared him. He sensed a level of engagement that I think scared him a bit in me. And the fact that I would insist that we double a bet after 5 or 6 weeks of involvement also. So he kind of chased me away. For a few years.
And he's been doing this for years, at 25 bucks a week.
You know, Scott, I think he was doing it for only about 2 years. He would occasionally go to a racetrack with my uncle.
Right.
He liked to invest in a stock market. But he was a man who was very conservative with his money. You know, making sure that he had money to send me to college. My mom and him were just, they lived a life to make sure that they could send me to college, because neither of them had gone to college. And everything kind of stayed quiet for a couple of years. I finally got to college, and I discovered football sheets where you had to pick a minimum of 3 games. Mm-hmm. And I would play those. It was cool to do, and everybody would like to boast, hey, you know, I won a sheet this weekend. You only play it for a dollar or whatever. But in junior year, I actually decided to play a sheet I picked 10 teams over the course of the football weekend. Some of the games were on Saturday, some were on Sunday. And when we got to Sunday at 4 o'clock, that sheet was 9-0 with 1 game to go. It was a Raider-Chief game, an Oakland Raider-Kansas City Chief game. Now, the payout for picking 10 correctly was 350-1. So my $1, I no longer was risking a dollar. I had already counted that as one money. So it was a to me, it was a $350 bet. And I felt juiced and extremely important because my three friends who were my roommates were all watching this game. And we were going to go out for dinner, naturally, probably with a credit card that night because there were no ATMs back when I was in college. But needless to say, I lost that game. But the excitement I got from it was just unbelievable. I think as a consolation for picking 9 out of 10, you even got $20. But it still felt like a loss. But that was when I first got my taste for lack of a better word, high-stakes gambling, because for a junior in college, $350 was a serious amount of money.
Well, I'm just thinking of the bazaars back when you first started. It was the sounds. It was the atmosphere.
Magical.
It's beautiful. It's magical. I can see where the sense of that can
people
can
were friendly.
Your senses, and it's around people. But this is just a little chart. This is a chart where you're putting a pencil to boxes. And somewhere along the line, it went from having a great time with a lot of people to the juice and nothing but the juice of
right.
God.
And if I won that 10th game, being able to be a big man on campus, hey, Ray picked 10 out of 10 on that sheet, I would have felt like a god to all the guys and all the houses, the jocks that were on the football team. And that was something that I was already anticipating occurring until the game didn't go down to the game was basically over at the halftime. Whichever one of those teams I bet on, and I don't know which one it was, just got destroyed. It was 28-0 or something like that at the half. So we kind of knew that this wasn't going to go down to the wire. But although I may have still won $20, again, as I said, I felt I lost. And what I really lost was a lot more than that ticket or that sense of empowerment that I would have had, because by the time I graduated from college a year and a half from then, Scott, I was a full-fledged compulsive gambler. Now, my dad died the summer of junior year. And my inability to probably completely mourn him might have played a role in it, but I became totally crazy with my gambling in senior year. By the NC2A tournament that the Indiana would win that year, Rutgers, if you remember, had a great basketball team. And I remember with one of my roommates, we must have bet several thousand dollars in the course of the big Friday of the NC2As. And when it was all said and done, I think we each ended, because all our bets we split evenly, I think we each lost $30, just the way the VIG worked out and the different size of the bets. And I just looked at him and I said, you know, this was the greatest expenditure of $30 I ever had. And he looked at me and said, me too. What a night. We were just glued to watching games and getting updates and going up and down when the scores came in. And that began I was betting sums of money that were ridiculous in the opening of the baseball season. And by the time I got to graduation, I had lost a tidy sum of money. Every dollar that I owned, and I had worked very hard in summer jobs, had to borrow a little money from my mother to cover some of the remaining losses. And there's no doubt that I had already kind of crossed the line in my gambling.
So when you were, you probably had a chance you could have run the games, right, and made some money being the VIG, right?
It's possible, but that would have never satisfied me, because the thought of picking and being right, the need to be right and being able to anticipate which team was better than the other team, but this was a trap game because they were going out of conference and they had a big game. Somehow being heady enough to be able to figure out which teams are going to win, for me, was as important as winning the money. So being on the other side of the action would not have really kind of done it for me. Yet.
So the games are big. Did along this way, as you were betting on games, now football, but also basketball and all sorts of sports.
Yeah,
did it end? Did you go to lacrosse? Did you do women's soccer, or did you?
I compulsively gambled, Scott, for 18 years, and 98% of the money I lost on the force: basketball, baseball, hockey. And did I say football? The four big sports.
The four big sports.
I managed to bet some money on horses. I went to an occasional casino. Also played some money in the stock market. But those three things just did not do it for me as the sports did.
Now, did you feel the same about the stock market as you did about the games, or were the games, I guess they're less predictable than the stock market? The stock market is, you can't predict it, but you've got a better bet probably on a stock market bet than you do with your games.
I think you do. There wasn't this sense of instant gratification in the stock market. Right. And, you know, a stock would incrementally go up, would incrementally go down. And maybe over the long run, you were doing okay if you happened to get advice on a few
stocks.
But
you had to wait.
But it was more like an investment. And you know, some my stock market stuff came when I got tips from people. It wasn't like I did any financial analysis and figured out that this was a good industry or this was an excellently run company. I was just there to kind of – it seemed like something good to do, but it took too long. It didn't – it wasn't as instantly gratifying as the win or losses of a sports game were.
Young people today and middle-aged people, I imagine as well, and maybe even some older people have fantasy leagues now, and they just – it's changing the face of a fan, I believe, sometimes, where they're looking at – they could be cheering against the team they've rooted for their entire lives because of this one player who's on their team that's actually on the opposing team right now.
That's right.
I find that amazing where it's come to – is that gambling?
I think anytime there's an element of chance where you have the opportunity to lose money, it has to be gambling. You know, I can see where some people might say that's not as bad as betting whatever it is on a single baseball game. But I guess I've gotten to the point where I have too much respect for the program to want to even differentiate on things. I mean, it's clearly gambling. And there are some people that may start there, and then after a while, that may not be as instantly gratifying because they may see that they're moving ahead on a week, but some of them, they don't win until the end of the season, but they watch their teams all the way. Whereas you can kind of say, you know, this is taking too long. Let me try something else. So it's gambling. It just may not be as quick a turnaround as some of the other types of gambling there are.
It's still about the action. It's called gambling. It's the addiction of gambling. Not everyone has it, but some of us do. Do you? We'll talk more about it with Ray when we come back on Stepping Out Radio. Stepping Out Radio, our subject is gambling, the addiction of gambling. I'm Scott Clark. With us today is Ray, who is good enough to share his experience, his strength, and his hope with us. First comes the experience. But if you think that you may have a problem with gambling, if it's beginning to affect your life in an adverse way, if you can't stop, honestly, if you just think about it, can I stop this? Can I really stop this? If you think you may need some help, there is help there. Here, www.12stepmedia.com. That is our website. Again, it's www.12stepmedia.com. When you're there, you can sign up for our free newsletter or drop us a line. We'd love to hear from you. Denise McEntee, our wonderful producer, has a great newsletter out there, and we'll be happy to speak with all of you. Gambling is our subject. There's also Gamblers Anonymous, where most gamblers who are out of control with their lives go to get help and get help. Ray is one such person. He is going to tell us about how he got help and what his life has been like since he got help, but this is what got him there. It's called gambling to a point where you do things you intuitively would not do. You're at college, you graduated, you're broke, you're in debt.
Not in debt. Well, a little bit of money I owe to my mom, yes.
Okay. But, mom.
That's right.
So mom, was she an easy take, an enabler, or she just didn't want you to be in trouble, or I guess what an enabler
can
do?
I think they were one and the same.
Yes, they are.
You know, when I graduated college, Scott, I thought life was great. You know, I had graduated from a good school. I had a good job that I was starting right after Labor Day. And most importantly, when I got back home, I lived in Brooklyn. I was able to find my first bookmaker, you know, because when I was betting in college, I had to bet through another college friend and everything, and I didn't like other people knowing what I was doing, especially if I was losing. And, you know, if I had to bet through a friend, whereas now I had my own bookmaker. So I thought that I was the king of the world. I was ready to seize the world by its horns.
Now, at this point, gamblers, you usually do hear about when they win. But do you get to a point where whether win or losing, you didn't want to tell anybody? Was this an isolating effect?
I think it was an isolating effect for me, you know, because I like to pretty much work on my own. I had a few friends from college who had graduated and lived in other cities, and we would talk about who we liked on the weekend and stuff like that. But I would not really share with them how much I was betting. I might agree with them that I was going to bet teams A, B, and C, but not get into the amounts. And it, for the most part, for me, it was purely an isolating thing. I lived to be around the TV on Sundays. You know, my phone, you'd call sports. I was calling sports phone all the time to get the partial updates. It was pre-digital world. We didn't have PCs back in the mid-70s. So I was very much by myself and really wouldn't even answer the phone because there was no phone to tell you who was calling. So I was on my own.
What would you do when the week was starting to go badly? In the middle, at halftime, you've lost your 4 out of 5 bets or 10 out of 12 bets are down and looking not very good.
Right. Well, interestingly enough, for me, there was nothing more exciting in the course of a week than being down big money in the middle of the week and winning it all back over the weekend. That was as pleasurable as it got. It was more pleasurable than being on a 1, 2, or 3 week winning streak, because when you're losing and the whole world gets simplified, the only thing you can focus on now is winning back that money, especially if you didn't have the money, especially if it meant that you're going to have to concoct a story to explain to your bookmaker why you weren't going to be able to pay him that following Tuesday or Wednesday.
That can be troublesome.
It could be. But, you know, if you develop a slow pay reputation with bookmakers, they will give you some room to operate. And I happen to have a job that would, at the end of a year, pay out a bonus and all. I worked for a bank, so I could use, I'm getting a real big bonus at the end of the year. Stick with me. I still need to come into you. You got to take my action. And that would just create more troubles more often than not. But when you were in the middle of that losing streak, whether it was a weekly losing streak or if you settled up at the end of the month, that was nirvana, because you had no time to worry about anything else. It was full absorption. Whereas if you were on a winning streak, at times you had to look around and realize that everything else in your life wasn't so great. Maybe, hey, you know, I haven't been out on a date for a month, or I haven't called my mom for haven't taken out for dinner for a couple weeks. And, you know, whatever it may be, you'd suddenly resurface. But when you were losing, you were in that submarine, and you were flying without radio contact, because that's the way it got for me when I was on a losing streak.
When you were, when your mother was getting a call from you during those days, was it usually about getting money, or did you mix it up every once in a while and say, hey, Mom, I haven't taken you out to dinner, and by the way, I'm in debt?
Yeah, you know, when my mom wouldn't get a phone call, I would call my mom when things were going well, Scott. And even if I was losing some money, but it was affordable money,
would you share with her that things were going well?
Well, I wouldn't really talk about my gambling, but I would just call like a dutiful son and, you know, just have a nice little conversation with her, tell her what was going on in my life. And if nothing was going on, I might make up something to make her sound good. I went out on a nice date and I saw this young lady. But when I was on that losing streak and in that submarine submerged, as I said, I would lose contact. So when my mom wouldn't hear from me for a week or so and she heard my voice on the other end of the phone, her voice would start to quiver, because she knew the drill. Even before I asked her for money, you told me this wasn't going to, Mom, I know, I'm sorry. And it was a lot of painful calls, but, you know, on the other hand, I needed that money, Scott, to stay in action. And my mom had some money. My dad had left her fairly well, and it's not like I was deliberately preying on her, but it was the easiest place for me to go when I ran out of any access to money on my own.
But in essence, that's what you did in the end. You did prey on your mother.
Absolutely. I was a financial and emotional terrorist to her.
How much money did you take from your mother?
I would say that at least $200,000, possibly a quarter of a million. I don't know for sure, but it was in that range.
And her loving son, a loving mother, is going to do what she can to try to help her loving son no matter what.
There's no doubt. I mean, she would take a cab from Brooklyn into the city to cash a stock out at her brokerage account and get the money somehow. What we had to do in those days, but if I needed $15,000 or $20,000, she'd come into the city and take care of that. And she'd come in her house coat and a little raincoat. And
Sure there was remorse, totally. Ray, yep. When this was going on, but it did continue, did it not?
It did. The remorse would be during that process, seeing how the unconditional love my mom gave to me. And when I'm missing work for several hours while all this is going on, and I'd put her in a cab and thank her and send her home and call up my bookmaker and schedule a meet. It might have been one or two guys I had to pay off. But by the next day, it was back to business again, and the remorse was totally, I don't know if it was totally gone, but it was shoved aside because that wasn't going to allow me to do what I had to do to win money and bet my game. So until I hit bottom again and needed that next bailout from her, perhaps in a couple months, it was forgotten.
And are you thinking still, I'm going to win it back? I can win it back?
No matter how much money I lost, Scott, I was convinced that I was not only going to win all of that money back, I was going to surpass what I lost by quite a bit.
This is Ray's story. I'm Scott Clark. Thanks for joining us on Stepping Out. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Stepping Out Radio. I'm Scott Clark. My special guest is Ray. He is giving us his story, his life, his experience, his eventual strength, and his hope as he lives one day at a time, not gambling, because this took him to dark, strange places. Mom gave you $200,000 to $250,000 before it was all over.
Right.
You talked about remorse, but still trying to get it back. At that point, now, where are you in your life? Are you in your 20s or your 30s? And what's happening in your life? You still have a job?
I was doing well. I was always a good earner, Scott, but it's not about the money. You know, whatever you earn, you're going to lose, and usually then some if you're committed to this compulsive gambling.
So you would lose your money first and then go to mom and ask her for
help?
I
would max out my credit cards, and I would go to some financial places that were legitimate that would charge, even back in the early 80s, 24% annual interest. Not that I could get much from them, but if I could get $4,000 or $5,000 from them, that mattered.
Was there fear of going to the bookie after a while?
I always assumed that there was some date that I didn't want to go beyond. So yes, I clearly had that. But the fear was not as important as being shut out of action. Because there were several times during the course of my 18 years of compulsive gambling where I would lose any access to gambling for about 3 months or so, and I'd save some money, and or sometimes, as sad as it may be, because my mom was, you know, a little bit older than the average mom, an uncle or an aunt would pass away and a little timely inheritance would come along and I'd be back in business or something like that, or inheritance that I would get. So it was more about being afraid of losing the action than it was about somebody roughing me up. And I remember during those times when I'd be not gambling for 2 months or 3 months, I always felt, I didn't know it at the time, but when I came back, I was like a bull in heat. The first couple weeks back, I would lose money that much faster because there was so much desire built up for action that I was just that much more reckless. And it always amazed me because I always felt that I could pick winners, but I told myself I had a money management problem. And I had to master the money management end, and if I did that, things were going to be fine. And I never mastered that. So,
where did it take you? How low did you go?
Just before I got to my first GA meeting, I was scared, beaten, and worn out. I wouldn't have been able to say this then because it's only with the benefit of some abstinence and recovery. But I can safely say now that I was I was bankrupt in every sense, financially, yes, emotionally, spiritually, and I think I was even bankrupt of self-respect at that point. I had just gotten to the point where my wife had two brothers and two sisters and great parents, and I knew that they were telling her that it was time to leave Ray.
Now, we haven't heard about the wife throughout this entire story. We've heard about Mom. Was Mom still around when you...
She was, yeah.
At the end.
Yeah, Mom fortunately lived long enough to see about 5.5 years of abstinence and recovery. But when I finally realized that I could no longer ask Mom for any more financial help, I had to begin turning to my wife. And that was a more delicate negotiation, and I had to be craftier and more manipulative and all of that.
But so you used your money, but did you guys keep it separate? Did you keep the secret? The gambling, did she know about it?
She never knew the amounts. And, you know, again, in those days, I was never going to gamble at home if she was home, so I'd stay late at work or I'd use a payphone on my way home because we didn't have cell phones yet. But I concealed it from her in every which way for as long as possible. She was aware that it had gone on for some extent, but I would also lie to her and tell her that I had stopped gambling. She was never quite ready to believe that, but I think she was hoping that it was true, because wives would hope that, you know, this kind of incredible behavior would end. And it was only when I was out of every other option and I knew I needed money to stay in action that I would finally say, hey, sweetheart, I need $10,000 or whatever it was that I needed.
Did she have it?
We had it in our savings. We did have it. We were both earning well, and I was, you know, and so there was money that was put aside that I was tapping into from her after I started to use her as my my backup source of funding.
So did that? I know your mother went to great lengths and to high figures. How far did your wife go? Did she? Was she as patient, as giving, as willing?
It was never as easy, and I was always filled with more guilt because I was coming home and living with her. And toward the end, when I finally stopped gambling, Scott, I had a 4-month-old son and a daughter who was almost 4 years old. So there was a lot of stuff going on in the house, and you know, it was much more difficult to continue to, quote-unquote, fleece my wife.
So what did you do?
I turned to some friends. I asked other relatives. Some of them told me to get lost. I did what I had to do. And finally, before I came to GA, I asked one of my best friends, who I had avoided. I was too ashamed to go to him. And I went to him, and I asked him for some money, and he said he'd call me back later that day to let me know what was up, and he had wired money to my account, and he said, I just need you to do one thing. You have to promise me that you'll make one GA meeting. And I had no reason not to honor that request. I was thankful that he had given me some money.
And we'll talk about what happened when, we'll see if Ray did go to the meeting when Stephen Al continues.
You got to know when to hold up. Know when to fold up, know when to walk away, know when to run. You never count your money when you're sitting at the table. There'll be time enough for count when the dealing's done.
Welcome back once again to Stepping Out Radio. Our special guest is Ray Scott Clark with you. We've been listening to and talking with his story, how bad it got, how remorseful, how humiliating it made Ray feel, but how Ray could not stop gambling, couldn't quit, gonna make it, never did. Your friend said he would give you the money to get out of your latest problem as long as you went to a GA meeting. So you got the money, and what'd you do with it?
I gave the money to my bookmaker so I could stay in action.
Out of trouble. You know, first things first, stay alive.
And it was early January. I bet some ridiculous games. And by then, Scott, I was no longer betting single bets on games, which is, you know, it gives you a chance to at least burn your money slower, if not win it. I had to always bet 2-team reverses or 3-team reverses. And that just meant that you were, if as long as you lost a game, you were going to get hurt. If they all won, you would win more, would have a multiplier effect. But if you lost one, it would have a multiplier effect in a negative way. So
what a sophisticated gambler.
Well, yeah, I got to tell you.
I can lose a lot more this time.
Speed of light toward the end.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that year.
But
that,
always with the thought of I can win a lot more.
That's true. I was almost out of money by the time the Super Bowl came around. I think the Washington Redskins would beat Buffalo that year in a Super Bowl. And I had a modest wager on that bet. And the next day, I bet a couple games in a Mid-American conference, teams like Kent State and Bowling
Green State University.
I knew nothing
Isaac
about.
Zumba, Zumba, Zumba.
Right, you know, but
my school.
You know,
and shout out to Bowling Green.
My last day.
Did you bet on Bowling Green?
I can't remember. Oh. I do know I went 2-2 on my last day,
okay.
So I lost a little bit of the vigorish. And that next Tuesday, I think it was the 28th. I went to my first meeting to honor my friend's request.
That money that you were spending, was that your friend's money still on the bets that you were undertaking then?
Well,
just to pay the guy
it
off?
It was to pay off to be able to lose some more money.
So you're taking your last little sprockets of things.
And I might add that I wasn't fully paying off. I was just making a good faith payment because, again, my angle was that come early February, I was going to get a mound of money on my bonus for the prior year.
Bonus.
But I needed to give them a little to just continue to have a good payment.
That bonus that was coming, was it going to cover all of your debts?
No, it would have to have been about six times higher. Five times higher, yeah.
Wow. And we're talking hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Yeah, I think back then my bonus might have been about $40,000 and pre-tax, and I probably owed out toward the end there close to $200,000.
Okay. So you went to the meeting. What happened?
I went there thinking I was going to be around a bunch of people that I had nothing in common with. And when you first go, they welcome you. They make you sit at the front of the table. Our room happens to be a fairly big-sized room here in the city. And they just say, look, sit there and listen for a while. We're going to probably call on you an hour and 15 minutes into the meeting. And I just started listening to these people talk, some younger than me, some older than me, and I could relate to something in every one of their therapies. It became pretty obvious to me that this was a place that I belonged in.
After probably one of the worst feelings you can have, and that is walking into that first meeting.
That's right.
With the fear and the trepidation.
That's right.
And actually going in and kind of acknowledging that I may have a problem.
Absolutely right. And, you know, Scott, they called on me, and I had to answer 20 questions. I think I answered 18 correct. Probably should have answered 20, but I was afraid to say yes to two of them.
Right.
And then they asked me to talk a little bit about myself, and I remember I cried during my initial share. And they asked me if I thought I was a compulsive gambler, and it was very easy and almost a relief for me to say, yes, I am a compulsive gambler. I grew up a Catholic, and I probably made my last real confession with a priest in eighth grade, kind of lapsed away after that, but there was no confession that I ever made that was more powerful than admitting I was a compulsive gambler that night.
That first night, did you gamble after that?
No, sir.
It took the first night. That's an amazingly good story.
It is. I was 37 years old, and I had a lot to lose by then. And so I had done a lot of damage over the years to myself and my family. So they only asked me to give them 90 days. And I wasn't sure that I was staying after those 90 days, Scott. But after I came back week after week, it became apparent to me that I needed to stay there. And I'm glad they only asked for 90 days.
And I'm sure you've seen, since you've been a part of the group, that there are people who do not stay and people who do go out and people who never come back and people whose lives are ruined because of gambling, because of their addiction, where their lives just were completely taken over.
Very true. I mean, we can get pathologically and maybe even neurologically programmed to where we become comfortably miserable with that existence. You know, gambling is like a bad friend, but a friend nonetheless. And when you know the drill of, oh, I'm down again, I owe out money, I got a bar, you know how to function in that existence. You're so used to it that it's almost comfortable.
What's your life like today?
Right. My life is, everybody said that when you stop gambling, and you stayed in this program and did all the things that the program asked of you, that your life would be richer than you could have ever imagined. And I can say that I'm living proof that that statement is true. I have a great relationship with my wife. I've grown up. I was very emotionally immature during my gambling years. Even though I was 37 years old when I came into GA, I probably was emotionally around 15 or 16 years old, because when you gamble all the time like that, you stunt your emotional growth. And I know that now. And you can't develop good life management skills. Today, I feel like I have all of those things, and I like to think I'm a pretty good dad and husband, but it's really up to my kids and wife to comment on that.
Ray, just one story here, but one of many who suffer from gambling addiction, and we want to thank you for sharing your story this day.
Thank you, Scott.
Thank you, Ray. Don't go away. Up next, you're going to be listening to Rick Benson, who is an expert on gambling addiction. I'm Scott Clark. This is Stepping Out Radio. Now, at this time, we would like to welcome Mr. Rick Benson. He is the director of the Algabas Recovery Center in Prescott, Arizona. Rick is here to tell us about Algabas' unique gambling-specific residential program. Rick, welcome to Steppin' Out Radio, and tell us all about Algabas, would you?
Thank you. It's wonderful to be with you, folks. We are a gambling-specific residential program in Prescott, Arizona. And our website's www.algamus.org. I think a couple of things that set us apart from a lot of other programs in the country that say they're gambling specific is that when you start to ask the hard question, which is, when I sit in groups as a gambling addict, how many of the people in the group will be gambling addicts, compulsive gamblers, pathological gamblers? I'll use those terms interchangeably. A lot of other treatment centers will then tell you, well, you'll be about 25% of the total population. We're very small. We have only 9 beds. We're in a lovely mountain home with some great views. And then we're doing group therapy and individual therapy pretty much Monday through Friday, half day on Saturday. We're supporting that with people attending Gamblers Anonymous, accompanied by staff. We obviously believe that treatment is about the process of self-discovery, and Gamblers Anonymous is about the process of sustained long-term recovery. At length of stay can run anywhere from 30 days up to about 70 days, and then obviously people are going back to their home environment. I also think that one of the things that really is a very sterling part of our program is the fact that we have a financial counselor on staff, a CPA type, who works in a three-part way with the drug of money for each and every one of the gambling addicts, both in group and in individual sessions. First, let's establish a complete look at the debt structure. Second, let's set up a workable, livable, modest budget. And third, let's derive a sound restitution plan. And when we're able to do that and we're able to stop that financial fire from raging any longer with the gambling addict, we're really assisting them on the road to recovery. In all of those ways, I'd like to think that our program is one that has benefited many gamblers over these years and will continue to do so. We're hopeful that we'll have another residential presence on the east coast of the United States sometime during 2010, and are working toward that objective presently. If there's anything we can do to be of help to any listeners on the show, including family members as well as gamblers themselves, don't hesitate to give us a call. Look at our website. Thanks again for the opportunity to be with you this evening. And Jeff, wonderful to hear you, buddy. And thanks so much. Take care now.
Rick Benson, thank you so much for being with us. Rick Benson, the director of the Algamas Recovery Center in Prescott, Arizona, here on Steppin' Out Radio. If you'd like more information on Algamas, it's www.algamas.org. Or call them at 800-818-4491. I'm Scott Clark. Thank you for joining us on Steppin' Out on this day, and we'll see you next time, one day at a time.